Okay. Good evening, everybody. Are you controlling the volume? There we are. Good evening, everybody. Good evening. I think we're going to get started now. Greetings, and thank you very much for coming tonight. My name is Michael Pollan, and I'm a journalist teaching in the Graduate School of Journalism here at Berkeley. And my job tonight is to welcome you all, those of you in this room, and thanks to the internet, those watching the proceedings in far-flung rooms around the world. We know in Mexico and France, and probably many other places. I want to say a few words about the critically important issue before us tonight, the suppression of scientific dissent, from the perspective of a journalist. And then I want to introduce our panel and then turn over the proceedings to this evening's moderator, Mark Dowie. I want to welcome you here tonight on behalf of the many, many organizations that collaborated to make this event possible. I shouldn't go first, but the Knight Program in Science and Environmental Journalism at the Graduate School of Journalism, the Bancroft Library Oral History of Biotechnology Project, the Department of Environmental Science, Policy, and Management at UC Berkeley, the Center for Sustainable Resource Development at UC Berkeley, the Berkeley Art Museum and its Genesis Project, the Council for Responsible Genetics, and the Jennifer Altman Foundation. What I think galvanized all these very disparate institutions to collaborate on this event was a shared sense that these are parlous times for scientific freedom in America and beyond. The blurring of the lines between public and private science, and the blurring of the lines between science and technology, perhaps, have changed the tenor of scientific discourse and diminished the tolerance for diversity and dissent. Not that tolerance of dissent is so alive and well elsewhere in the culture right just now. Just last month, a mildly critical miniseries about Ronald Reagan was yanked from the CBS television network. Last spring, you'll probably remember that a presidential candidate who joked about the need for regime change in Washington was all but charged with treason by the White House, as if regime change were not the very point of holding an election. And then, of course, there was that very silly episode, silly but serious episode, with the Dixie Chicks, who were excoriating for daring to criticize the president. But scientific dissent and suppression present a very special case, one that is much harder for those of us in the press to report on. And that's what I'd like to talk a little bit about today. Indeed, we don't even know how widespread this problem is. What you see before you here tonight are some pretty rare birds, exceptional scientists willing to speak out, willing to go public. What we don't know is how many others have been silenced or intimidated into simply not asking troublesome questions, not designing controversial experiments. Perhaps our panelists can give us some idea. My fear, and this is based on my own experience as a journalist, especially writing about industrial agriculture, is that the population of such scientists is large and growing. Like most scientists, we journalists cling to a faith that science is somehow above politics. And this leaves us, I think, ill-prepared to cover scientific controversy. Making matters worse, science journalism suffers from an acute authority problem. And I think that has a lot to do with the way we, or how poorly we cover these kind of issues. In a sense, science journalism today is at the point where political journalism was 30 years ago, pre-Watergate. Back then, when a political reporter wanted to know what was going on in government, he would simply ask a government official what was news, and the government official would tell him. And it was usually a him in those days. Journalists seldom decided the news on their own. Political journalism was essentially licensed by government. So how do mere journalists and editors, who know much less about science than they think they know about politics, decide what is newsworthy and important in science? Well, the dirty secret is we don't. More often than not, we let the most prestigious peer-reviewed scientific journals, Nature, Science, Lancet, New England Journal of Medicine, decide for us to essentially license our journalism. If they publish something, it must be important and true. This makes our job pretty easy, actually, and allows us to maintain our faith in a scientific enterprise floating above the dirty world of politics and money. But what happens when one of those Olympian journals we rely on decides to unpublish something? Or when the scientist with the controversial discovery is suddenly fired, or denied tenure, or publicly attacked? Well, we journalists get completely flummoxed. Does this mean the controversial discovery is no longer true? That the peer review process, the supposed gold standard, was really just tin? Suddenly, we don't know whom to believe or where to turn for the truth. We certainly can't assess the science on our own. We don't know enough. And so, faced with viciously competing versions of the truth, we fall silent and decide to concentrate instead on the latest diet. Now, why should anyone outside journalism care about this state of affairs? Well, because in such an information environment, the powerful interests challenged by a troublesome discovery can discredit that discovery simply by muddying the waters. With media attacks, retractions, firings, the very sorts of attacks that would actually bring more attention to dissent in the political pages of the newspaper usually bring only silence in the science sections. And this, I think, is a grievous loss for all of us, because it means there is no longer any need or pressure for the offended industry or interest to actually disprove the troublesome discovery scientifically, which is how we all learned in school the system is supposed to work. The answer to allegedly flawed science is supposed to be more science, not attack followed by silence. Now, the four scientists on our panel tonight have been courageous enough to go public about the suppression of their science. It is truly an occasion to have them all together in, well, almost one room, two rooms. All of them have made important and troublesome discoveries, and all have found plenty of trouble as a result. Their discoveries, published in some of the most prestigious peer-reviewed journals, raise serious questions about the environmental and health implications of the powerful technologies at the heart of industrial agriculture. Now, at the risk of offending all of them in one fell swoop, I'd like now to introduce our panel, who I think of as the Dixie Chicks of the life sciences. Arpad Pusztai is a biochemist and an internationally recognized authority on nutrition with more than 300 published articles to his credit. He was the principal scientific officer at the Rowett Institute in Scotland, where he worked on designing experiments to assess the safety of genetically modified food. His troubles began in 1999 when he discovered that feeding a certain type of genetically modified potato to rodents damaged their health. His research was suppressed and he was forced to retire. Joseph Losey, who joins us from Ithaca, is an entomologist and an associate professor at Cornell. Losey's lab studies the impact of genetically engineered BT corn on both target and non-target insects. His troubles began with the discovery, also in 1999, I think, that when monarch butterflies were fed milkweed leaves dusted with pollen from these plants, they sickened and died. The industry launched a campaign to discredit his work. Tyrone Hayes is Associate Professor of Integrative Biology here at Berkeley. He is an internationally recognized expert on frogs. His trouble began also in the dark year for American science, 1999, when he was hired to assess the environmental impact of atrazine, a widely used herbicide, by a company working for its manufacturer, Syngenta. He discovered that even small exposures to atrazine, as little as one part in a billion, interfered with the sexual development of frogs, turning males into hermaphrodites. Efforts were made to suppress, delay, and discredit his work. Ignacio Chapella is a microbial ecologist and an assistant professor of ecosystem science, also here at Berkeley. His troubles began in 2001 when he and David Quist discovered that transgenes from genetically modified corn had found their way or introgressed into traditional maize land races in southern Mexico, the species center of diversity. The industry launched an international campaign to discredit him and his work. And finally, allow me to introduce and then turn things over to our moderator, Mark Dowie. Mark is an award-winning investigative journalist who writes about technology and the environment. He's published 2 books and won 4 national magazine awards and served as both editor and publisher of Mother Jones magazine. I suspect his duties here tonight are going to prove the perfect preparation for the course he's teaching at the Journalism School this spring, How to Cover Scientific Controversy. So will you please welcome our panel and Mark Dowie.
My job is to set the ground rules for this evening. Before I do, I want to emphasize a couple of things that Michael said that it makes me very proud to be up here amongst 4 of my heroes in life.
Can you hear me? Now, okay. Okay. These gentlemen are not here because their science has been challenged, although it has been challenged. All science is challenged. Almost every experiment that ever been done is challenged by someone else in the field. That's the nature of science. And if tenure depended on unchallenged science, there wouldn't be any tenured professors in the world. They all go through it. No, these scientists are here because they challenged the catechism of a very powerful industry, the handmaiden of industrial agriculture, and the darling of venture capital. The next big thing, as the venture capitalists like to call it, biotechnology. Very sacred cow here in the university and everywhere where these gentlemen work. Their experiments were all reported, as Michael said, in peer-reviewed journals, and they had an immediate economic effect. I think it's important to emphasize that the effect that got these guys in trouble was not the scientific effect, it was the economic effect or the potential economic effect of their findings. That's why they're here, meeting together for the first time and to carry on a conversation, exchange their experience, and discuss the consequences before a live and global audience, as it turns out. So we're gonna try to keep this to 2 hours. From the very beginning, including Michael's introductions. It is a live webcast, and it's reaching Mexico, and Europe should be about ready to get up now, so there'll be some Europeans watching it as well, and who knows, in the Far East, potentially everywhere in the world. There are cards. I don't know whether you've been given cards or picked up cards. There are cards for questions. Whenever you have a question, just write it on the card. You can identify yourself if you want. On the card, you don't have to. And there are 5 brilliant post-grad students here who will come and pick up your cards. They will process the cards, and there will also questions coming back off the webcast through the internet. So we'll be getting questions coming through that door as well. So, and we'll accumulate the questions, and in the second hour, we'll give the questions to the panelists as they're processed. I'm going to ask each of the panelists to just give a 3-minute statement. They can say anything they want. And then we have asked each panelist to bring a question to the panel for another panelist. And hopefully that will begin the conversation that will be the most stimulating part of the evening. I'll be processing the cards, and I will be trying to keep people brief on the panel. And then when we do the questions, I will be fielding the questions in the second half of the meeting. So there we go. Who's going to start?
Well, it's up to you. You
no, you start. You start.
You are the moderator. Well, we all have to follow what you say.
Microphone.
The mic. There is no mic.
Oh, it's here.
It's behind you. It's on your chair.
Oh.
Oh, I see. Very, very good. Can you hear me now? Well, I am Arpad Pusztai. I used to be a very conventional scientist. I did my work, wrote a paper, published it, and nothing actually prepared me for what followed after my very simple announcement in 1998. This was a little television broadcast, 150 seconds of it, 12 sentences, in which because our money for the research which we did came from the British taxpayers, including myself, I thought that it was quite right for me to report back to them that what is the potential problem with GM food. We did a research which cost $3 million equivalent to the British taxpayer, and we found that there were some worrying developments. We had this genetically modified potato, which we fed as a substitute to rats, and we did get some worrying effects. In the long term, the genetically modified potatoes, even when they were fully cooked, did not support the growth of the rats. These were young rats. Now, you know that you can't do any experiments with children. So they were standing in for children. And we found that there were some problems, and we couldn't explain that. Then the next thing was that because young rats developed their own immune system, their endocrine system, their bacteria flora, they are in a sort of transition before they become adults. And we found that when we are feeding these rats with genetically modified potatoes, their immune system slowed down. It was not developing so well. They were, their organs, their guts, their pancreas, their liver were not developing as well as the ones which had been fed on the parent line, non-genetically modified potatoes. So we were really perplexed. Quite truly, I tell you that I was very perplexed, because we have taken the gene and the gene product after 6.5 years of studies for not seeing the things which we were seeing. And we couldn't understand it. And then we did some critical experiment which had drawn the attention, our attention, and probably even more importantly, the biotech industry's attention to the fact that insertion into the genome did cause some unpredictable changes with potentially harmful consequences. Now, the whole thing, I just, as I say, simple scientist, I reported these facts to my peers, which were the British taxpayers, and told them there are problems. And I don't see corresponding effort to clear up these problems. And that worried me even more. So I naively reported this to the British public, and the consequence of that was really quite unbelievable. I never thought that as a conventional scientist I would have reporters parking and living on my drive-in to try to get my views on anything. I'm a very polite and humble person that I couldn't really understand that, how this happened, till somebody explained to me that what I put my foot in was a multi-billion dollar business. Now, that has never really came to my mind. I'd reported something which was science, and there were all these implications. So I leave this to you to ponder on, that how does a straightforward, simple scientist get into this field of major international controversy? And perhaps you are better equipped to deal with it than I was. Perhaps the rest of the panel is better equipped to deal with it, but I leave it to you. Thank you.
Tyrone.
My name is Tyrone. Am I on?
Yes, you're on.
And I have to say the one thing that we certainly have in common is that I was very naive in the sense that I was asked by a company to evaluate a chemical, and I, at the time, certainly didn't think about the implications or about the compound, or it was just simple science that I was getting into. I study amphibian developmental endocrinology, which means I'm interested in the role of hormones in frog development, and in particular, the role of sex hormones, testosterone and estrogen, the same hormones that are important in human sexual development, as well as thyroid hormone, another hormone important in growth and neural development. And I was, in part, encouraged by the university to develop one of our models as a test, one of our amphibian models, as sort of a test for example, compounds that might induce breast cancer. So we were studying estrogens that might induce breast cancer. And as part of filing a patent, you are encouraged to show efficacy, that if the university invests in your intellectual property, that you know, there's the possibility that it will bring in money. And it did, in fact. I ended up consulting for Novartis, which then became Syngenta, and they asked me to evaluate a compound, atrazine, an herbicide, that, again, I was very naive. It turns out it's the number one herbicide used in the world on the U.S.'s number one crop. It's primarily used on corn. We tested the compound, and we found that this compound, atrazine, caused male frogs to develop female characteristics. Male frogs would develop ovaries and, in some case, would develop eggs in their testes. And would also chemically castrate or demasculinize exposed males. Their testosterone would go away, and they would start to make estrogen. I reported this to the company, to Syngenta, to EcoRisk, which was the consulting company working for Syngenta at the time. And what they encouraged me to do was to repeat the work and to continue to repeat the work at a slower pace. And I should point out that I wasn't, and still am not, opposed to repeating the work. It was a very surprising result. Very low doses, actually a tenth of what was reported here, 0.1 parts per billion. And it was a dose that, you know, is 30 times lower than what's allowed in drinking water for humans. It also turned out that the company was aware of publications that had shown the same mechanism, the conversion of testosterone to estrogen, had been reported in mammals, including human cell lines, and that there were data suggesting that atrazine, through the same mechanism potentially, might be involved in increased breast cancer and induced mammary cancers, or as they put it, earlier onset of mammary cancers in rats, and was associated with an increase in prostate cancers in their own factories, again, through what we're calling endocrine disruption potentially. I eventually resigned from working with Syngenta and EcoRisk, in part because of the ways that they had tried to slow the work, in my opinion, suppress the work. And I did repeat the work on my own without their funding. I was then approached by November of 2000. I was approached by Syngenta again with an offer that I should make a proposal to Syngenta to get involved with them in the research again. And my response was, how can I make a proposal for work that I've already done on my own money? Essentially, they tried to purchase the work that I had already done. And I did not think about that at all. I assure you, I refused to do it. Their next... their next approach was to request a meeting here at Berkeley, alone with me. And I invited instead my students, from graduate students, undergraduates, my dean, my chair, as many people as I could. But they proceeded with their efforts to discredit my work. They presented, they brought in a statistician who claimed that there were errors and that my students had made errors, etc., and I asked them to leave at that point. So I repeated the work, and when I published it, and I just did it. I did what my older peers that I looked up to told me to do. Just do the science, stick to the science, and stay out of the politics. So I did just that. I didn't say a word. And when I completed the work, I published it in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. And then I was contacted by the Environmental Protection Agency. And again, after I published a second paper showing that this effect occurred in the wild, a paper that I published in Nature, I was again contacted by the Environmental Protection Agency, which was sort of my second piece of surprise. They repeatedly, including over email, warned me not to provoke the company, that the company was big and that they would attempt to destroy my career. These are things that the EPA warned me about. But we continued to publish the work, and the company then continued to hire multiple scientists who would present themselves as independent scientists from University of Florida, from Michigan State, from a number of universities, who would do things like, for example, repeat the work but not care for the animals, so 90% of the animals would die, and so they would claim that they didn't repeat our work, things like that. And I think one of the biggest losses in that is that they were often hiring students to repeat that work. So some of the people that they hired to quote-unquote repeat my work were students getting their PhD. Some of the students, such as one at University of Florida, managed to get out of the situation and start her career over. Others finished having just repeated my work and repeated it very poorly. One of the other discouraging things is I discovered in the middle of this all, I was asked to review a proposal by a major company that does, you know, some bioscreening and testing, a company called Battelle Laboratories, I guess. Can I name names? Somehow, somebody didn't pay attention, and I was asked to review the proposal, which turned out to be verbatim, word for word, my work plagiarized out of copyrighted published books. And so I approached the EPA about this. This was a company that the Environmental Protection Agency was making a contract with who will do this kind of amphibian work. And I approached them with it, and their offer to me was, what if we contract some of the work to you? My response was, wait, you've stolen my car, and now you're asking if it's okay if you let me borrow it on the weekend. When I brought this up to the Environmental Protection Agency and said, if I catch my students in my classroom plagiarizing, they would get kicked out of school. The reply from the Environmental Protection Agency was, the rules that operate in the ivory tower do not function in the real world. And the other thing that was disappointing to me was that the company completely denied having seen my data when it became public. And when I reported to the EPA and said, look, I have the Federal Express receipts of when I sent the data to them, instead of being prosecuted for not turning in data regarding adverse effects, there's a law against that, the EPA allowed them to revise their story. And the company revised their story saying, well, we saw the report, but we never saw the raw data. And then when I faxed a copy of my raw data with their handwriting on it, the EPA then sent me another email and said, well, this is an offense, and they're going to be prosecuted for it. And then a couple days later, I received an email that the company had surprisingly arranged a meeting across the street from the EPA, and that was the last I heard of the case. Anyway, I'll stop there with my series of disappointments. And
All right, we're keeping John Losey up late in Ithaca, are you, John?
Yeah.
So why don't you go next?
Okay, thank you, and I'd like to thank Ignacio and the other organizers for inviting me to be here, in a sense. And I just wanted to echo the sentiments of not being prepared for what happened when I published my work. I'd only been on the job for about a year and a half when I first started this project, and actually wasn't what I ended up publishing on was on some non-target effects of BT corn, which is a transgenic, genetically modified strain of corn. But it's not what I started out looking at. I started out looking and thinking more about resistance and that the target pest becoming resistant to that corn. But what we found when we were out in the field, some of my students and I, is that if you go out among BT corn fields, and we were looking for weeds that were around those fields, that those weeds got dusted with the BT corn pollen. And so I started to wonder, knowing that the toxin is expressed in the pollen, which is a mobile, the only mobile form of the plant tissue, what would happen if that BT pollen was dusted on milkweeds, which we saw that it was out in the field. So we brought some milkweed leaves in, we dusted some with the BT pollen, we dusted some with non-BT pollen, and we left some undusted. And what we found was, surprisingly, that when the monarch larva, the caterpillars, ate the leaves that were dusted with the BT pollen, about half of those died after 4 days. But when they ate either the non-BT pollen or the leaves without pollen, none of those caterpillars died. And what was surprising about that is that there had essentially been no research other than the target pests and a few other pest species that had been looked at before this corn was released out into the environment. And so I did that work. I shared it with a large group of my peers that work on corn. I actually shared it with both Novartis and what was then Novartis and Monsanto. And it's just interesting, and I guess this is part of the reason for this forum. We also had they requested a meeting here at Cornell. And so they came and suggested some different wording in the paper. In fact, they people from Novartis pretty much came out and said, we'd really rather you didn't publish this. You should go back and get more data. And my thought at the time was that this corn was already out on over 20 million acres. And the time for getting more data was 5 years ago before it was released. And now was the time to... We didn't have a definitive answer, and in fact, I don't think we still have a definitive answer on the effects of pollen on these other butterflies, but if we sat on it another year longer, that would be another year that it was out there on 20 million acres having unknown effects. And so it, in my mind, it was definitely the time to put it out for the public and my peers, and after it's been almost 5 years since that happened, and there's been a couple of dozen labs that have worked on that, and we still don't really know the sort of long-term subtle effects that the pollen might have on these populations. And not only do we sort of have a partial answer for monarch butterflies, we know there's not going to be a catastrophic effect on those, but some of the other work we've done shows that there's almost 200 species of butterflies and moths that live in and around corn. And so we don't have a final answer for the long term on the monarch, and we don't really have any data for any of these other 200 species. And that's, I think, what's a little disconcerting. In terms of my own experience and what happened with my work after it was published, the maelstrom of press that surrounded the publication of the article was just like nothing I've ever seen before, and I had never dealt with the press before that happened, and so it was overwhelming, and certainly there were a lot of industry folks that were trying to denigrate what we found or put it in a light that would make it seem like it's not important. And one of the most interesting things that I found was that I didn't just get it from the industry side. What I felt like was happening, and what apparently is a fairly common phenomenon, is that we published a very well-defined one-page paper with some data on what happened in the lab, and didn't really speculate on what would happen in populations in the field, other than saying that we needed more research. A lot of environmental groups extended what we said in our sort of carefully worded data from what we found in the lab to say that, well, this may have grave implications, could cause monarchs are going to go extinct, and so are all these other butterflies. And then the industry groups are shooting at me for saying that monarchs are going to go extinct, even though I never really said that. So it's sort of this idea of building a straw man and shooting at scientists for things that they didn't say. And it seems like that's happened in Ignacio's case too. It'd be interesting.